back to Scars Left Behind, episode 34, Panic, Defence, Law, India and Climate Change. LGBTQ plus panic defence. Strategy is a legal strategy that asks a jury to find that a victim's sexual orientation or gender identity / expression is to blame for a defendant's violent reaction, including murder. It is not a freestanding defence to criminal liability, but rather a legal tactic used to bolster other defences. When a perpetrator uses an LGBTQ plus panic defence, they are claiming that a victim's sexual orientation or gender identity not only explains but excuses a loss of self-control and the subsequent assault by fully or partially acquitting the perpetrators of crimes against LGBTQ plus victims. This defence implies that LGBTQ plus lives are worth less than others. One of the most recognised cases that employed the LGBTQ plus panic defence was that of Matthew Shepard in 1998. Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old college student, was beaten to death by two men. The men attempt to use the LGBTQ plus panic defence law to excuse their actions. Despite widespread public protest, the defence is still being used today. The LGBT bar uses LGBTQ plus panic rather than gay trans panic because the former is an inclusive phrasing which recognises that the defence strategy impacts all folks in the LGBTQ plus community. To refer to it as gay trans panic excludes violence against those who do not identify as gay or transgender. Traditionally, the LGBTQ plus panic defence has been used in three ways: to mitigate a case of murder, to manslaughter or justified homicide. Defence of insanity or diminished capacity. The defendant alleges that a sexual proposition by the victim due to their sexual orientation or gender identity triggered a nervous breakdown in the defendant, causing an LGBTQ plus panic. This defence is based on an outdated psychological term, gay panic disorder, which was debunked by the American Psychiatric Association and removed from the DSM in 1973. Sadly, while the medical field has evolved with our increasingly just society, the legal field has yet to catch up. Defence of provocation. The defence of provocation allows a defendant to argue that the victim's proposition, sometimes termed a non-violent sexual advance, was sufficiently provocative to induce the defendant to kill the victim. Defendants claiming a provocative advance stigmatized behavior, which on its own is not illegal or harmful, but is only considered provocative when it comes from an LGBTQ plus individual. Defense of self-defense. Defendants claim they believed that the victim, because of their sexual orientation or gender, was about to cause the defendant serious bodily harm. This defence is offensive and harmful because it argues that a person's gender or sexual identity makes them more of a threat to safety. In addition, LGBTQ plus victims' behaviour falls short of the serious bodily harm standard, or the defendant used a greater amount of force than reasonably necessary to avoid danger, such as using weapons when the attacker was unarmed. The LGBTQ plus panic defence frequently draws on stigmas particular to LGBTQ plus people, their sexualities and their genders, to justify horrific violence against LGBTQ plus individuals, the defence is rooted in homophobia and transphobia. The defence is rooted in homophobia and transphobia, considering intersectionality, particular individuals have higher likelihoods of being victims of hate crimes. As we have seen in 2019, there has been an increase of transgender women of colour being victims of hate crimes. In the United States, the estimated adult LGBTQ plus community makes up 5.6%, an estimated 18.4 million people. Hate crime statistics from the FBI show, however, that LGBTQ plus people are disproportionately targeted. In 2019, there were 1,656 recorded hate crimes against people for their sexual orientation and gender identity. These hate crimes made up a combined 18.8% of motivation in single bias hate crime incidents. Research shows that one out of five lesbian, gay and bisexual people living in the United States will experience a hate crime in a lifetime, and more than one out of four transgender people will. Next segment. India reported a global record of more than 314,000 new infections Thursday as a grim coronavirus surge hits the world's second most populous country, sending more and more sick people into a fragile healthcare system, critically short of hospital beds and oxygen. The 314,835 infections added in the past 24 hours raises India's total past 15.9 million cases. That's 15.9 million cases since the pandemic began. It's the second highest total in the world next to the United States. India has nearly 1.4 billion people. A large number of hospitals are reporting acute shortages of beds and medicine and are running on dangerously low levels of oxygen. The New Delhi High Court on Wednesday ordered the government to divert oxygen from industrial use to hospitals to save people's lives. You can't have people die because there is no oxygen. Beg, borrow or steal, it is a national emergency. The judges said, responding to a petition by a New Delhi hospital seeking its intervention. The government is rushing oxygen tankers to replenish supplies to hospitals. India's health minister, Harshvardhan, said on Thursday that demand and supply is being monitored round the clock. He said in a tweet that to address the exponential spike in demand, the government has increased the quota of oxygen for the worst hit seven states. The surge has brought pain, fear and agony to many lives in New Delhi and other cities. In scenes familiar across the country, ambulances are seen rushing from one hospital to another, trying to find an empty bed. Grieving relatives are lining up outside crematoriums, where the arrival of dead bodies has jumped several times. I get numerous calls every day from patients desperate for a bed. The demand is far too much than the supply, said Dr. Sanjay Garaz, a doctor at Bengaluru-based Santi Hospital and Research Centre. I try to find beds for patients every day, and it's been incredibly frustrating to not be able to help them. In the last week, three patients of mine have died at home because they were unable to get beds. As a doctor, it's an awful feeling, Garaz said. India has launched a vaccination drive, but only a tiny fraction of the population has had the shots. Authorities have announced that vaccines will be available to anyone over the age of 18 from May 1st. But India won't have enough shots for the 600 million people who will become eligible, experts say. Health experts said India had let its guard down when the virus seemed to be under control during the winter, when new daily cases were about 10,000 and it lifted restrictions to allow big gatherings, some experts say new, more infectious virus variants, in particular a double mutant variant that originated in India, are largely responsible for the spike in cases, but many also blame the politicians. The second wave is a consequence of complacency and mixing and mass gatherings. You don't need a variant to explain the second wave, said Ramanan Lakshminarayan of the Centre for Disease Dynamics, Economics and Policy in New Delhi. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government ordered an extensive lockdown last year, in the early stages of the pandemic, but has been wary of the economic costs of more tough restrictions. In recent weeks, the government has come in for criticism for holding packed political rallies for local elections and allowing a Hindu festival at which millions gathered. So, things are not looking good at the moment, but hopefully they will get things under control. Now, the final segment is on climate change. More than 170,000 migrants were apprehended at the US-Mexico border in March, the highest number in a decade. Many of those are unaccompanied minors, and the Biden administration has scrambled to find accommodations for them, sending hundreds of kids to temporary shelters in convention centres and other ad hoc facilities. Conservative politicians and pundits have blamed Biden for luring children to the border by relaxing Donald Trump's harsh immigration policies, describing the situation as Biden's border crisis. The narrative of crisis at our southern border is hardly new, nor is the inhuman treatment of asylum seekers, particularly children, which is a perpetual feature of an immigration system designed to be punitive. The real crisis isn't the number of people attempting to cross the border, it's the combination of violence, poverty and environmental disasters in the countries in Central America that asylum seekers are fleeing. Most people are coming from Honduras and Guatemala, where last November two major hurricanes leveled homes, contaminated water systems and destroyed farms, displacing an estimated 9 million people even before the hurricane persistent drought had created a hunger crisis and made life impossible for many subsistence farmers. Border crossings tend to follow a cyclical pattern shaped by numerous factors, but particularly by conditions in migrants' home countries. What is happening now is not so different from previous spikes in the number of children crossing the border. In 2014, during Barack Obama's presidency, and in 2019 under Donald Trump, then as now, many are fleeing violence and poverty, but environmental stressors are increasingly a contributing factor. In Guatemala, the situation for children is increasingly dire because of last year's hurricane. The economic impact of COVID-19 and crop failures linked to drought, all of which have contributed to food insecurity. Guatemalan children suffer the sixth highest rate of chronic malnutrition in the world. According to the Washington Post, it's quite clear that the frequency and severity of these natural disaster events have increased and that is indeed a factor preventing development, preventing the improvement of the lives of children and families, and a factor in pushing migration, said Carlos Carrera, the Guatemala country representative for UNICEF. Extreme weather is already the leading cause of forced displacement worldwide. And as climate change accelerates, environmental catastrophes will increasingly drive migration. According to analysis by the New York Times and ProPublica, in the case of extreme warming, more than 30 million Central Americans, American migrants, will head for the United States over the next three decades. While natural disasters often cause rural to urban migration, Violence in cities makes it more difficult for people to relocate internally and can prompt them to leave the country altogether. Research from the Duke University and the University of Virginia recently found that climate change and violence together are driving increased migration from Honduras. In the period between 2012 and 2019, when rainfall decreased, the number of Honduran families apprehended at the US-Mexico border rose. That number increased even further during periods with higher murder rates. US immigration policy is totally unprepared for the coming climate migrations. Even if governments around the world take aggressive measures to limit greenhouse gas emissions, warming will continue to some extent, making life impossible for millions. People fleeing environmental disaster are not considered refugees under international law, and so do not have even the modest legal protections of people who leave their homes because of conflict or persecution. In February, President Biden issued an executive order mandating a report on climate change and its impact on migration, including options for protection and resettlement. Advocates hope this could be a first step towards creating a legal category for climate migrants. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey introduced such legislation in 2019 to create a humanitarian program for climate displaced people, which would function similarly to the refugee resettlement program. But so far, the Biden administration's posture on migration remains predominantly one of containment, treating it as a problem that should be stopped, if not with a physical wall, then by delegating border enforcement to other countries and increasing aid to Central America in the hope of improving conditions, enough to reduce migration. In April, the administration announced new agreements with the government of Mexico, Guatemala and Honduras to take measures to make it more difficult to make the journey and make crossing the border more difficult. In the words of White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, the administration has continued to expel migrants by invoking Title 42, a public health statute that the Trump administration used to sidestep asylum law and return asylum seekers to Mexico without a hearing or formal deportation process. Biden also had not yet fulfilled a campaign promise to lift the low cap set by Trump on the number of refugees admitted to the country. Far fewer families have so far been permitted to seek asylum today than under the Trump administration in 2019. Aaron Reichlin Melnick of the American Immigration Council wrote earlier this month, with the normal route for seeking asylum at ports of entry largely cut off, people are trying to cross in more dangerous conditions. The Biden administration has a four-year, $4 billion aid plan for Central America, which could alleviate real suffering. But it doesn't address the question of how to treat people who are already on the move or those whom aid won't reach. The root cause of migration that the Biden administration is trying to address through aid are intimately connected to the history of US military intervention and drug war policymaking in the region. As Felipe Delahaz writes in the New Republic, but very few people in the mainstream political conversation are even broaching the idea that perhaps it's this country's responsibility to receive those fleeing the situations it created. Similarly, the United States bears a significant share of responsibility for climate change. As the country with the largest cumulative greenhouse gas emissions in the world, 700 times the carbon dioxide that El Salvador, Guatemala and Honduras together have emitted since 1900. For decades, politicians have been debating how best to stop migrants from coming to the United States. a question that inevitably leads to abuse. Like the detention of children in poor conditions, which both Democrats and Republicans have now decried. No policy wall strengthening of a frontier or of border controls is really going to address the underlying issue, said UNICEF's Carrera, pinpointing that problem as the massive inequities that exist between countries like Guatemala and the United States. Migration is inevitable. Let's be clear. It's part of human history. It's part of our reality. Of course, every effort should be made to improve economic, social and environmental conditions so that people aren't forced to flee their homes. But systemic change takes time, and climate change will cause some degree of devastation and displacement, regardless of how aggressively policymakers respond now. It's a crisis that raises a very different question about migration. What would it look like to have an immigration system that treats movements as normal? Necessary, a viable path on a rapidly changing planet. Follow us on Instagram at Scars Left Behind. That's behind without the E. You can also find us on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Acast, Anchor, Google Podcast, Breaker, and on Listen Notes.